Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2022 podcast series. This event was proudly supported by the Consulate General of Canada, Sydney.
Hello. Welcome to Melbourne Writers Festival 2022. I'm very happy to be here with you in human person. Before we get started, I'd like to respectfully acknowledge that today we're meeting to talk about storytelling and the importance of narratives on the land of the Kulin Nations, in particular the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people who never ceded sovereignty. We pay respects to their elders past and present and to the elders of all communities and cultures across Victoria. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. My name is Sarah Krasenstein. I'm a writer. And today I feel so lucky to be here with Sheila Hetty, about to beam in to have a chat about her work and her latest book, The Beautiful Pure Color. Sheila started off studying playwriting at the National Theatre School of Canada. Because of the breadth of her creative work since that time and our limited time with her today, I'm going to mention only some of the wondrous individual and collaborative acts of creation that followed. In addition to her novels, Sheila writes literary and arts criticism, children's books, and her play, All Our Happy Days Are Stupid, was staged to sold-out runs in both Toronto and New York. She has a serialized project with the New York Times using 10 years' worth of her diaries, is a founder of the Trampoline Hall Lecture Series, and as an interview editor for The Believer magazine, explored new terrain with Elena Ferrante, Agnes Varda, and Joan Didion. Most of us here are very, and I know from some of you very devotedly, familiar with her last three novels, each one itself only, spectacular, confronting, surprising, and formally inventive. How Should a Person Be, Motherhood, and Pure Color. As different as faces, each explores, amongst many, many other things, the eternal artistic tensions between availability and inwardness, authority and doubt, community and solitude, influence and originality in art making, and the search for meaning that is consciousness. Pure Color has been called a galaxy of a novel by a philosopher of modern experience. It offers a new beginning for the novel. So let's get on with it and welcome Sheila Hetty to Melbourne Writers Festival.
Hello. Hi. Thank you.
So as moving as this book is on the page, and you can see I brought it, I've done my homework. There's nothing like hearing it in the author's voice. So Sheila is going to start us off today by generously giving us a little reading from the beginning.
Yes, I'm going to read off a PDF on my computer, I think. That way I can look. Oh, I've got it. Hold on.
I've got a brand new.
As you know, my computer died a few days ago, so I just got a new one and I couldn't seem to, maybe not all my files were downloaded. Anyways, I have the actual physical copy here. All right, here we go. I'm going to start reading from the beginning. Yeah. I'm just going to read the first few pages.
Cool.
Okay. After God created the heavens and the earth, he stood back to contemplate creation, like a painter standing back from the canvas. This is the moment we are living in, the moment of God standing back. Who knows how long it has been going on for? Since the beginning of time, no doubt. But how long is that? And for how much longer will it continue? You'd think it would only last a moment, this delay of God standing back, before stepping forward again to finish the canvas. But it appears to be going on forever. But who knows how long or short this world of ours seems from the vanishing point of eternity? Now the earth is heating up in advance of its destruction by God, who has decided that the first draft of existence contained too many flaws. Ready to go at creation a second time, hoping to get it more right this time, God appears, splits, and manifests as three art critics in the sky. A large bird who critiques from above, a large fish who critiques from the middle, and a large bear who critiques while cradling creation in its arms. People born from the bird egg are interested in beauty, order, harmony, and meaning. They look at nature from on high in an abstracted way and consider the world as if from a distance. These people are like birds soaring, flighty, fragile, and strong. People born from a fish egg appear in a flotation of jelly and this jelly contains hundreds of thousands of eggs, where the most important thing is not any individual egg, but the condition of the many. For the fish, it's less any one individual egg that concerns them than that the eggs are laid in the best conditions, where the temperature is most right and the current most gentle, so the majority might survive. For fish, it's the collective conditions that count. A person hatched from a fish egg is concerned with fairness and justice here on Earth, on humanity getting the temperature right for the many. 1,000 eggs are the concern of a fish, whereas the person hatched from the egg of a bear clutches one special person close as they possibly can. A person born from a bear egg is like a child holding on to their very best doll. Bears do not have a pragmatic way of thinking in which their favorites can be sacrificed for some higher end. They are deeply consumed with their own. Bears claim a few people to love and protect and feel untroubled by their choice. They are turned towards those they can smell and touch. People born from these three different eggs will never completely understand each other. They will always think that those born from a different egg have their priorities all wrong. But fish, birds, and bears are all equally important in the eye of God. And it wouldn't be a better world if there were only fish in it. And it wouldn't be a better world if there were only bears. God needs creation critiqued by all three. But here on Earth, it is hard to believe it. Fish find the concerns of the birds superficial, while birds are made impatient by the critiques of the fish. Nothing makes a person feel like their life's work or their self is less seen than when it's being judged by someone from a different egg. Yet birds should be grateful that someone is making the structural critique so they don't have to. And fish should be grateful that someone is making the aesthetic critique so they can focus on the structural one. God is most proud of creation as an aesthetic thing. You have only to look at the exquisite harmony of sky and trees and moon and stars to see what a good job God did aesthetically. So those born from the bird egg are the most grateful of all. Those born from the fish egg are the most upset, and those born from the bear egg aren't too happy either. Perhaps God shouldn't conceive of creation as an artwork the next time around. Then he will do a better job with the qualities of fairness and intimacy in our living. But is that even possible? For an artist to shape their impulse into a form which is not, in the end, an art form? This particular story concerns a bird-like woman named Mira, who's torn between her love for the mysterious Annie, who seems to Mira a distant fish, and her love for her father, who appears as a warm bear. The heart of the artist is a little bit hollow. The bones of the artist are a little bit hollow. The brain of the artist is a little bit hollow, but this allows them to fly. Those who aren't hatched from the bird egg might wonder why it was birds who center their thoughts on their own selves, who were born to give the world its metaphors, pictures, and stories. Why should it have been given to the birds? A bird can learn to walk on the ground like a bear, and they can spend their whole life walking, but they will never be happy this way, while a fish on the shore gasps for breath, desperate to get back to the sea. How Mira would have loved to be born of the bear egg. How she would love to be an ambassador of a simple and enduring love down here on this earth. Yet whenever she sets her heart on such actions, they are wished for, strived for, and barely achieved. To properly love another one, this is the stumblingest part of her, the most nonsensical part, the part of her that is most scattered and always to blame. But she shouldn't feel bad about being a bird, for how beautiful are the flowers in her window. The flowers on her windowsill over there, how their petals and leaves make each passerby smile that someone loves beauty and cares. Her flowers make us think of the flowers in the soul of the person who put them there. It is the flowers in the soul of the person who put them there that make us happy and enliven our hearts. The beauty of the flowers is a clue to the beauty of a human heart. They are a keyhole into a human heart. And a fish's good act, even the smallest action, effectively done, is a glimpse into a human heart. And a glimpse into one heart is a glimpse into many. And the hopes of the bear are shared by all of humankind. And what opens one heart opens many.
You're getting a big round of applause. Thank you so much. That's remarkable. So to start us off, I thought I'd do a little appetizer question of asking you your thoughts on time and space. We are getting right into it today. But I am always really curious about the role of duration in your work. with pure color, I'm thinking about its necessary strangeness and its singularity, not just in the context of the rest of your work, but I think generally in terms of fiction today. In its rhetorical register or its feeling tone, it feels less like it's of another time and more like it's outside of time as it's often depicted. So for those of you still to read it, I'm not referring so much to the fact that it starts in the before times, certainly before COVID, but specifically in the analog world that some of us grew up in. I mean that in its concerns and the phrasing and pacing of their unfurling, it feels mythic or biblical or scriptural, and at times like a fable or a parable. These forms were how we traditionally contemplated and came to terms with our mortality and that great divine mystery we only refer to as the numinous. In its feeling, texture, and its imagery, language, and form, the book feels both radically new and uncannily familiar. So can you speak a bit, Sheila, about the genesis of the ideas in this book and your experience of time, either how it impacted the writing process itself or how it figures in the story or however that resonates for you?
I think that, you know, what you say about fables and myth and so on and the biblical, that kind of register feels very easy for me to write in because I think that my mind sees things in broad strokes and generalities. And I think if you're somebody who goes through the world noticing like the particularity of things and details and how things are different from each other, then you would write in a different way. But my brain always sort of makes everything like everything else and is always seeing how one thing is like something else and putting the world into bigger and bigger categories. Mm. And I think, you know, the form of fable or myth does that too, because, you know, it deals with archetypes and with sort of very concrete, clear, vivid storylines. I mean, I think that there's that in this book, like the storyline is very concrete, in a sense, and very simple. And I don't know, it's just the way that, you know, I think when I was writing this book, my very first thought when I very, before I even knew what kind of book I was writing, I wrote down on a piece of paper that I wanted a book that couldn't be encapsulated in a single sentence because I felt so sort of hurt by the way that motherhood had been talked about, like that it was just about a woman in her 30s trying to decide whether or not to have a child, which it is, but it's also other things. And I just didn't want this book to be able to be reduced down to anything. And so I kind of feel like that was also one of the starting impulses. I don't know. There's a bunch of, and so how time comes into that. I mean, and I think when I first started writing, my first book, The Middle Stories, I really didn't want any pop cultural references and I really didn't want anything that could locate it in a certain place or time or that could, that had to require some kind of in knowledge to get, you know, my mother came over to me and my boyfriend's place a couple of years ago and we had a picture. I think the New Yorker had like written a story about Charles Schulz and there was a picture of Charlie Brown, like a full page picture of Charlie Brown. And we had taken it out and put it on the fridge for some reason. And she came in and she said, "Oh, who is that sweet boy?" And so like her not knowing who Charlie Brown is also made me, I think, feel like you can't use something like Charlie Brown. You can't use sort of very specific references in your writing or else somebody like your mother won't understand it. So that I think also very early on in my writing in my early 20s, like started me on this track of like a kind of lack of cultural specificity in certain respects.
Yeah. Wow. That's great.
That didn't really answer your question about time, but I'm sure I'll answer it in the course of the next hour.
No, that's great. And it foreshadows some things. Well, I wasn't going to ask about Charles Schulz specifically, but it leads quite nicely into some of the other questions. I'm not sure if it's being an artist or the thing that drives one to become an artist, but I think it's a wondrous thing to have access to this seemingly secret knowledge in our modern society, at least, that even death can literally and metaphorically give color or open up new colors. And I think that's connected to something that I deeply appreciate in your work, which is that you use the full register of the human voice to talk about the full register of human things. It's also, I think, to some degree, fairly radical because we have these socialized silences, very limited of a menu of acceptable emotions that our society usually enforces around death. Why do you think that's still the case? I guess I'm asking specifically about grief in the book and kind of more than that, like the experience maybe of feedback from readers having, you know, to talk about something that could only be put, you know, in the, you know, 60 to 70,000 words of the novel itself.
I don't know. But the first thing that occurred to me as an answer is, I think if you don't, you know, if somebody very close to you dies, and the main thing you say is not about how sad you are, you seem like a monster, and you seem like you didn't love them, and, you know, that you have no heart. And I think when my father died, my experience was so magnificent, an experience. It felt so transcendent and so profound and so exciting. Like, it felt no different probably than seeing somebody give birth for the first time. It felt that raw and important and connected to everything in life. And I felt this unbelievable elation, even though I love my father. But if you talk like that, it sounds like you don't, and that you're happy that somebody you love is gone. And so it's very hard to talk about that aspect of it. And I think if a person can't talk about all the attendant feelings that go along with something like witnessing the death of somebody you love, then you just, it's better to say nothing at all. And maybe that's why no one really talks about it, you know. And then you have these sort of phrases, you know, that just sort of stand in for all the things that you're sort of afraid to say for seeming like a ungrateful, or, you know, is my father listening? What's he going to think if he hears me in the, from the afterlife saying this, you know? Yeah. So there's all sorts of taboos, I think, around saying really how interesting it can be to have such a profound change in your life from one moment to the next. And one moment you're a daughter, and in the next moment, you know, you, what I felt was like, I hadn't realized to the extent to which my father, as a parent, I think maybe, I don't know if I say this exactly in the book, but it's like having like an umbrella or something in the rain. You know, there's always this feeling like there's somebody who cares about your, well, not for everybody. I know families are different, but in my case, somebody who cares about your safety and wants to protect you. And then that's gone and you're sort of alone in the rain or something. You just, or you're out exposed to the elements. And, you know, that's scary, but it's, that's also really thrilling. And, It's incredible to feel something so new that you've never felt a single day of your life. So I kind of, and I felt, you know, I felt I could write all this stuff down, I think, because my father was such an eccentric man. I don't think that if there is an afterlife and your parents watch you from it, then he would have been upset about it.
Yeah. We get the sense of that, I think, beautifully in the book. This next question is not, I guess, one about process. But again, I think because the book, like the rest of the book, like your novels, covers so much ground and is about so many things, even writing these questions was challenging because, you know, to write the questions itself, I'm writing a small book in response to the book. So it's a long way of saying, excuse me if I'm seeming to take a long time to get to the question. I'm going as fast as I can. Robert Motherwell said that art is an experience, not an object. And the experience of grief is like another planet for those yet to be initiated. As writers, we're condemned to use words to evoke or gesture towards feelings, which are sometimes seemingly beyond language. And like I said, in pure color, you do that so beautifully. I'm thinking how you started off in theater and the attunement with which you discuss painting and painters, and also this idea that Marshall McLuhan kind of spoke to when he described Cubist art as an instant sensory awareness of the whole. So that's something I'm pretty jealous of regularly as a writer, because our relationship with our audience, our readers, is different, and text is necessarily more gradual in its telling or capacity to communicate meaning, and therefore perhaps more tenuous. I'd love to know why you've chosen books as your first love, and how other art forms, I guess I'm thinking specifically either theater or visual art, continue to influence your work in different ways.
I don't think writing is my first love. I just think it's the one that I'm good at. I think that acting would probably have been actually my first love, and theater. I mean, if I could spend my days in a theater rehearsing a play with other people, I would I could feel as an actress the same way I feel when I'm writing. I would have way preferred that life. But I didn't feel that way when I was acting. I felt very wooden, and I felt like I wasn't accessing the universe in any way. I felt like I was pretending, you know, I never transcended myself. And so that couldn't be my art form, even though it was my first love and remains so. And I think that I sort of can act still in some ways through the writing of books. Like, How Should a Person Be felt very much like the years that I was writing it, that I was playing this character, which was the Sheila of the book. Collaboration with other artists and writers as a way of sort of bringing what I miss about the theater into my writing life. So yeah, I don't think it's my first love, but it's somehow the one that I've always been, I've been able to do it in some way. Like, yeah. When I was a kid, I remember people liked my stories, you know, and I remember also like seeing my friend sitting beside me in class, and we had a drawing assignment, and I wanted to be a good drawer, and just beside me there was somebody who was an even better drawer. And so you have some sense early on in your life of your capacities. And I think that I don't see how you can go against the evidence of the world, you know, that tells you what you're good at. And it's really lucky if the evidence of the world sort of like dovetails with how you feel when you're doing it. You know, so I felt best writing, and I got positive feedback for it. And so that ended up why I became a writer. But I don't think that I'm most, I don't think it was a choice in the sense of I think it's superior or anything, or that it's what I would have chosen. I would much rather spend my days in the theater. I'd much rather spend my days painting. You know, I think that sitting in front of a computer is not physically like that nice a way to go through the day. It's much nicer, like my friend Margot, like to be in your garage with paintings all around you, standing up, listening to music, seeing your progress right in front of you, than staring at your computer and trying not to online shop when you should be writing your book. Like, that's not a fun way to spend. It's not like the best way to spend your day. If I could choose, I would choose something else.
Yeah, no, I feel you. This next question is kind of more, I guess, as a reader, I'd say more as a reader than a writer, but answer however you please, obviously. But this idea of, you know, what we can get from the experience of standing in front of a painting, or, you know, being in a theater, seeing something that's never really going to happen again. And then the experience of what we would love to get, what we come to books for, and what we would love to get as opposed to what we do get. Do you think that there's anything that is truly unwritable?
Everything's unwritable. I mean, it's none of it is writable. But that's the feeling that I have. You know, you can't really ever get it. You know, you're writing, and because you can never really capture anything the way that it is in life. That's, I think, why the writing becomes about writing, because that's the only one-to-one literal thing you can do is make the sentence how you want it. Yeah. The sentence can be exactly how you want it, but it's never going to be a lamp. It's never going to be the day you spent at the beach. You know, it's always just going to be a sentence.
I feel coming back to pure color. Once Mira transubstantiates into a leaf, she gains a new perspective on the span of time and the human need for activity. And you write, plants have learned over millions of years how to be the audience of creation. Here, and I see it running through your work, particularly motherhood and how should a person be, and the journals, is that bloody tension between doing and being, that balancing act, which is hard enough for normal humans and near impossible for artists. I'm thinking how deftly you've drawn the experience of those tensions in art and in life between, and these are just a few of them, authority and doubt, craftsmanship and compulsion, influence and originality, and relationship and solitude. And of what the Jungian analyst in How Should a Person Be might say about the energizing potential created in balancing the tension of the opposites. Have you found more certainty over the years of actively working with these questions? Or on the other hand, has it just given you kind of an increased tolerance for the generative potential of conflict itself?
I think anybody at 45 is going to be more comfortable with all this stuff than they are at 25. I think, you know, if you are trying to live a good life, you get better at these things and you see what matters and what doesn't matter. And apart from loving people, like most things don't really matter. So you sort of become less neurotic, or I have, and I've made fewer like catastrophic mistakes like in the last 10 years and in the 10 years before that. So I think living does that for most people, you know? And so I think in terms of writing, I've maybe become a little more accepting of the fact that my books are not going to be they're going to be a surprise to me. Maybe they're going to, I always want to write the books that I have loved. I always want to write Crime and Punishment. I always want to write Anna Karenina, you know, and I think as the years go by, it's just more and more clear that I'm just going to write the books that I write. And as I write more books, it becomes clear what that is. And so I feel like that's like, in one sense, sort of, you see your limitations, but that can be very freeing because you can only be yourself and you can only be the kind of writer that you are, and, you know, and who the kind of writer you are, you can't change that because you have a certain brain, you have a certain capacity, you've had certain life experiences, you've read certain books. Like, it becomes more and more clear that you don't really choose what kind of writer you are. It's an expression of yourself. And, you know, I think when I was younger, like when I was 25, I would have chosen to be a different self, you know, and at this point in my life, I wouldn't. And, you know, when I was 25, I would have chosen to be a different writer, and more, I mean, I'm still struggling with that a little bit, but like more and more, I wouldn't, you know, but I think it's still, maybe in 20 years or something, I'll be totally content with it. There still is like this dream of writing a book that you could never actually write given the way that you're constituted. The same way when you're 25, like there's a dream of being the kind of person that you could actually, or looking like a certain kind of woman that you would never actually look like. There's always this longing to be like exactly the opposite of yourself or exactly other to yourself. And then eventually you adjust and adapt. you give up that futile hope. And I think it's the same way a bit with writing. But it's slower. It takes more time, I guess, for me anyways.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that kind of like the damp acceptance of what is and what we are. I have this very funny, like, ongoing conversation with one of my friends here who's a novelist, Stephen Amsterdam. Some of what you hear about, be familiar with him. And whenever I feel that, oh, the disappointment with finding out what it is I actually wrote as opposed to what I would have hoped to have written, he kind of reminds me of this thing that he heard once, which was, you know, we set out to write about, you know, the cosmological span of time, and then the book is about a man moving a plate from one side of the room to the other. And, you know, that's what we, that's what we're called to do, and that's what it was.
And that is kind of about the cosmological span of time, moving a plate from one side of the room to the other. So it sort of works out, actually.
So what a wonder, you know, Carl Sagan, to build to bake an apple pie from scratch, you first have to invent the universe. I mean, that plate is a big deal. Right. This isn't my next question, but I am curious about kind of that discovery of, I guess, not just who we actually are or are becoming, but what the work is itself. Like, do you find that so far what you've set out to write and what you've written, that kind of discovery about not just meaning, but form in the kind of ideas themselves as you sit with them, given how long it takes for you on each book, is that kind of, how much are you directing and how much, I guess, are you listening to or discovering from the material itself?
I mean, I don't know how much. It's completely both, you know. It's like 100% both or something. Because like we were saying earlier, like an idea in your head is a very different thing from words from a book. And so it'll never be the thing in your head because they're not the same. The space in your head is not pages with words on it. And so it'll never be that. It can't. So then how does that impulse, you know, in the blackness of the mind or whatever, like, how does it find its expression on the page? Like, that'll be some kind of surprise always. And it'll always be something different. And, you know, and then in terms of being led, like, for me, it's a matter of, I read over what I've written, and some things I've written I think are great while I'm writing them. And then you look back and it's like, this is not good, but this other stuff is good. And so you have to cut the stuff that's not good. And I feel like on a very practical level, that's the being led. Like, you cut the stuff that's not good. And so that's, I guess you're being led by your taste or something. Like, I mean, you can make it more mystical than that. And sometimes I do, but I think on a practical level, that's just all it is.
And I think that's really anyone here who's kind of emerging writer or secret writer. I think kind of that notion that it's supposed to be a discovery and a messy one and something that it's not going to go according to plan and it shouldn't. I think that's really important. And it never becomes less important, I think, because the perfectionism of, oh, this isn't what I'm intended to do, or this isn't where, you know, the research I was hoping to, you know, leap off from should have taken me. It's a sign, that kind of messiness, that conversation with, you don't even know what part of yourself or what part of the material, that's going to be a sign, I think, that we're on the right track most of the time, rather than, you know, it wrote itself or it just poured out of me.
Right. I also feel like a good sign is there's like when things are going, when I realize I'm writing a book, you know, it's often like strange synchronous things start happening in my life or in conversations or this or that, like the whole world, the book seems to somehow like expand to the whole world and things happen in life that make you feel like you're on the right track somehow.
Well, see, speaking of synchronicities, I'm now going to depart from my very anally structured questions and ask you one about synchronicity. This is about Sheila's Diaries serialized project for the New York Times series. For those of you who haven't discovered it yet, I highly recommend it. She put 500,000 words of diary entries into Excel, structuring it alphabetically to bring out patterns and echoes and make kind of a self-portrait and a profound work of art and meaning-making. Sheila, you explained it like this. I blurred the characters and cut thousands of sentences to introduce some rhythm and beauty. When the Times asked me for a work of fiction that could be serialized, I thought of these diaries. The self's report on itself is surely a great fiction, and what is more fundamental mode of serialization than the alphabet? So the effect of mixing and alphabetizing those entries creates so many beautiful patterns, and they have a kind of Jenny Holzer-like oracular quality. This alphabetical constraint, I did a creepy amount of research for today, and I listened to your second podcast episode on Between the Covers with David Naiman, who I'm sure that his voice comforted many of us on our sad little lockdown walks. But he referred to this as having a Ulippian quality, Ulippo being the mostly French, mostly male group of writers and poets and mathematicians who created works using certain constraints. So, long way of saying, reading that series made me think about found meaning and synchronicity in the Jungian sense of meaningful coincidences between the exterior world and our interior questions, dilemmas, needs, desires. And in this serendipitous way, our availability and openness to the world brings us the guidance we need when we need it. Something I love about Pure Color is its cosmology. And one of our most talented new novelists, Ella Baxter, said that it could be its own religion. Whether it's that kind of busily active Old Testament God or depth psychology or the I Ching or tarot or physics, this interplay between external systems of knowing and an internal locus of moral authority is something I see running through the work. Does that feel right to you? And how close do you think we can get as artists or as humans to certainty?
I mean, it does feel right. As you're asking me that question, I was like, oh, I've got to ask her to send me her questions after this. They're really, really so great. I feel like I just want to like relive them. They're so good and make me feel so good. Certainty. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It's not really something that these days is a word that I feel that troubled by. I don't know what you have to be certain of in order to live. Mm-hmm. I think that not being certain is just more dynamic. Yeah. It's more interesting. It's more open. It's more curious. More sensitive. I'm not looking for a certainty, I don't think.
Yeah. I think that maybe it's, maybe a better word might be, I'm not using this in an Instagram kind of a way, like wellness, but am I well with putting this on the page? Like, am I well, can I stand by it? Does it feel congruent to me that this is as it should be and what I'd like to say and what I can, you know, stand by. I feel like that kind of.
I think you have to cut everything you don't feel like that about.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's why my books are short, because like there isn't that much that I would feel like that about. Like there aren't that many sentences that I want to read. You know, when you write a book, like as you and I'm sure most of the people in the audience know, you end up rereading it so many times, you just have to. I mean, all the stages, you have to read each page. You end up reading each page like 50 times. And so if it's something that feels bad to read it feels bad that you're the one that wrote it, like cutting it the first chance you get is the best thing you can do. So I think that kind of certainty is necessary, you know, but it's not really certainty. Again, like it's just taste, you know, it's like this is gross. This is not something that I want to encounter again. I'm embarrassed that I wrote that, you know.
One of the joys of doing it in public. All right. So this one, I'm now getting back onto the neurotic, ordered train. Both of us are Jewish with Eastern European forebears, brought up secularly, but both of us attended religious schools. You, as I understand it, Anglican for a few years, and me, Jewish for all of it. I'm curious here about the confusions of that kind of contrast on one hand, secularism, but this like religious environment, how it impacted things like a sense of cultural clarity or belonging on the one hand, and on the other hand, whether it kind of opened up a wealth or inheritance of shared story or symbols and meaning making.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy that I had a religious, however secular, that I had a religious kind of environment. I think just because it's interesting to feel connected to generations and generations and generations through a culture of storytelling. Like that's sort of how I understood Judaism was we at Passover every year we tell this same story, and this has been going on for thousands and thousands of years, and every Jewish family does that. And I think just the craziness of that, like the like really like, and your mind just kind of talking about time, like your mind when you're a kid, your mind like can hardly conceive of like all the families 5,000 years, you know, over the past 5,000 years or however many years, 3,000 years, I don't know how many thousands of years Passover has been celebrated, but you can't, you know, I think that's what religion does. Maybe not the newer religions like Scientology, but like the other religions, like they situate you in your sort of humble, specific life in this grand context of meaning. And I feel like, you know, that's what I got from the Jewishness of my family. And I think that's one of the most important things probably that I experienced as a kid growing up was that feeling of like, yeah, that contrast or that strangeness. But, you know, there was never a sense that one had to believe in anything. And I think that those two things together, not having to believe in anything and at the same time feeling connected to this history, that's a very nice combination.
Yeah. We're coming up to our final 15 minutes, so I'm going to try to get in all my darlings now. As opposed to keep make you stay here for the rest of the day, which I would also love. When you read out at the start the bit about the critics, there were a few kind of wicked, gleeful laughs in the audience, and I certainly felt that reading about the American Academy of American Critics in Pure Color. You've spoken before about the influence on your thinking of the book Manet and his critics. And when I was revisiting some of those more brutal assessments or willful misreadings of his work in preparation for today, it reminded me of the similarly brutal and, in my opinion, misguided contemporary criticism of Chekhov's first play, which was The Seagull. You mentioned earlier motherhood had some polarized responses. And to me, those seemed mainly like readers who appeared to be projecting some discomfort with their own situation onto the work. I understand that your early readers are friends, and most of those friends are artists themselves, and I love this for so many reasons. It creates a kind of a holding environment for work that has been traditionally, perhaps masculinely, locked into a rugged individual process. And you've turned it into a form of mutuality or community. And the second reason I love it is something you said, again, in my creepy research, in another interview recently, that artists are the only critics that I can take completely seriously. So what is it about the artist / critic that better places them to give you that feedback?
I was just reading this Kierkegaard essay for this class that I'm co-teaching, and it's the essays, A Crisis. I never know what the exactly how to say it, but it's like The Crisis or A Crisis in the Life of an Actress, or maybe it's A Crisis and the Crisis, or the Crisis. Anyways, it's about A Crisis in the Life of an Actress, and it's a beautiful essay that I love. And it's about how he wrote it for an actress friend of his, actually, who was in, I think, turning 30, and she had been a very famous actress since she was a teenager. And he talks about the crisis as simply, it's another way of saying aging. And so she ages out of being the young ingenue that everyone's interested in because she's so beautiful and young, and becomes this woman who is in a different relation to the audience because they're not interested in that aspect of her. But she has a deeper relationship to her own creativity, her own work, and so on. And it sort of talks about how she only becomes, he calls it a genius, when the accident of her youth sort of falls away. It's really incredible. And there's something about Kierkegaard, and he says, like, what the critics, when she's young, what they are talking about and what they are seeing is the beauty of her youth, and they can't see her talent or her, you know, her gift, really. So they just see the accident of her youth. And I think, you know, so to contrast this idea of the accident on the one hand with something more like a relationship to one's internal self, I feel like the reason that I like other artists as critics is because I feel like they don't notice the accidents. So an accident might be the fact that you're a woman, or an accident might be the fact that you're whatever your race is, or it just, you know, some accident, you know, I feel like, or even the accident can be like what you chose to write about. Like, here's a book about horseback riding or being a cowboy or whatever. Like, I feel like the bad critics just see the accidents, and they're just talking about the accidents, and the artists can see the inwardness. Yes. And I feel like that's why that they're more trustworthy, you know, because as an artist, you are the accidents you just have to work with, you know. Yeah. The fact that you're a 25-year-old woman or whatever is just like an accident that you have to work with. And maybe it appears in your book, but and a bad critic will think it's about that. But a good critic or an artist will understand that, like, actually it's about the inwardness. I just realized this like a week ago when I was teaching this in the class. I was like, oh, that's why, that's exactly what I thought. Oh, that's why I like other artists as critics, because they see different things. Yeah. They see what you care about.
Yeah. I think that's, and perhaps, yeah, the kind of what's possible in, a reasonable expectation of how the feeling or how the idea can be communicated, and what, rather than an unreasonable kind of level of perfection that would only satisfy them, an awareness that they're using their own entirely subjective criteria to begin with anyway. I feel like the feedback is more useful. I mean, I don't think it has anything to do with being kinder or gentler, because it can be super, even more brutal to hear, yeah, it from someone you admire or love for, you know, those reasons of friendship or
absolutely.
All right. So I just wanted to going back to the journals, and kind of that line in the explanation that the self's report on itself is surely a great fiction. I'm thinking of the uses of autofiction as a label specifically, and more than that, the requirement that we shoehorn creative work into any genre generally. In terms of the degree to which the Sheila on the page is the Sheila whose name appears on the cover, or the literal accuracy of the father in Pure Color, the mother in Motherhood, the Margot in How Should a Person be, do you encounter readers or critics who feel entitled to that clarity? And in the end, does the distinction really matter?
I think that they feel entitled to that clarity less than they did 10 years ago or something. I mean, I think people, or 15 years ago, I think there's like, or no, 10 years ago, I guess. I guess How Should a Person Be came out in 2010 for me. So I feel like then I was getting a lot of questions about what's, you know, how much of this happened, how much of this didn't happen. Like there was a lot of concern about that. And now I think because of this word autofiction and so many other books, there's, well, it would seem really tacky to ask and to ask that question at this point. So I think people don't, but I think that curiosity is still there. I mean, I have it when I read a book, you know, I don't think that that's a bad thing to wonder what the difference is between the text and the author. I think we want to know because we want to know what's possible in the life, you know? So I think that curiosity comes out of a really nice place, you know, and a place of like doubt about one's own life. So that's where the curiosity comes from. Like you read a book and you think, can this be possible? You know, and that's why we want to know how real it is or how much happened. But I think it does matter. I think it does matter whether things happened or didn't. Because that is a clue to what's possible or not possible in your own life. And I think the fact that it does matter is what makes this genre so interesting. Yeah. I think the fact that we can't know, like you can't actually get any clear answer to that question. And so you kind of have to take it as fiction, but you don't want to take it as fiction because you want it to do more than that. You want it to be like a nonfiction report that you can, hold your own life up against. So I think the frustration of this genre is like what makes it kind of exciting and alive. Mm. Like the frustrations that it causes. Yeah. That causes me too when I read other people's books.
Well, I think that's the tragedy of the tragic side of the glory that is true enough to feel true. And that might be the kind of only truth that ultimately matters. Not generally, I'm a mostly factual writer. So obviously it matters for factual writing in that genre. But ultimately, the idea that this exists in the space of pure possibility, where it, you know, it feels like life and it is relevant to a life and applicable in its spirit to how to live a life. I mean, that's the kind of truth I think most of us come to books for in our own ways. Maybe.
Yeah, and also like things from the imagination can be also true. I don't mean to say that people that write books out of their imagination aren't writing things that you can learn from and that you can apply to your own life. But somehow when it seems to be autobiographical, then there is this urge to know, because you can't just take it as a story. You know, when you just read something that's like purely, nothing's purely invented, but when you read something that is obviously more invented, you take it as a metaphor or something like that. But with these books in the genre of autofiction, it's not just a metaphor, and you don't even know if you can take it metaphorically. So it's hard to know how to read those books.
Yeah. Which is, I think, why I love them.
Mm-hmm, me too.
So I listen to a lot more podcasts now than I did at the start of the pandemic. We were very locked down for a very long time in Melbourne, and there was a long period where we could only leave our house for the purpose of exercise for 2 hours a day. And so there was lots of
exercise for 2 hours a day. Wow.
Yeah. So all of us were out walking madly walking. And on my sad little walks, I would listen to a lot of Backlisted, which is a podcast that I love now. And a line from one of the episodes, which had to do with going back and rereading kind of beloved books, has stuck with me. Books are like friends, they betray you. Can you share a bit about your influences, those books that inspired you to start or keep going with the writing, and any books that you return to regularly, and whether there were some that actually betrayed you in the sense of not being what you thought they were, or as good as you thought they were, somehow disappointing.
Well, so Thomas Bernhard was very big for me in my 20s. I loved him, this Austrian writer. And I don't know if this is exactly the question that you're asking, but I mean, I know it's not what you're asking, but I recently read a book of his, The Woodcutters. And I felt like this was one of his books that I hadn't read, and everyone was saying it was his best book. And I thought, well, I like The Loser better, but okay, finally, like a month ago or 2 months ago, I thought I'll read The Woodcutters for the first time. And I read the whole book, and I didn't remember ever having read it. But I'm sure I must have read it, because I realized reading it that my book Tickner, which was my first novel, the book I wrote after my, which was my second book, was so similar to it. Like, I almost feel like, I mean, I thought at the time I was inspired by Thomas Bernhard, but reading this book, possibly for the second time, it has to be for the second time. I felt betrayed by myself. Like, I felt like, how did I not realize how close this is to that book? And I think that's, there's something sort of beautiful about, like, you're trying to write and all you can really do is imitate the writers that you love. But the blindness, like the totally not seeing that until now, 20 years later, reading it. So that's like one kind of betrayal. I don't even think that I should be saying this publicly, you know, but yeah, it's a, I really ripped that book off. And yeah, I'm kind of horrified. But the other kind, the, I mean, I don't usually reread books that I love, but I have started to do that lately. And I have not felt betrayed. I've always only felt like, it feels like a new book, you know, like obviously if you read a book when you're 20 and then you read a book when you're 40, it's like a, and it's a great book, you know, it's a new book. You have a completely different relationship to it. Yeah. And I think that's when you were talking earlier about how in the theater, you know, it's never the same night after night. Yeah. I actually think the same is true of books. Like it's never the same. You're never going to, the books change, you change. So the book changes too.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Did the pandemic change your kind of reading habits at all, or your, what you were looking for?
I don't think so. No, I don't think it did.
There was a long stretch where I only kind of read Japanese fiction, but from like the early 1900s, and I was like, how did I get here? Done a very long Kindle Googling hole, but it was so soothing. The tone, it was just really soothing. So we have 3 minutes left, and I just wanted to ask, I think that you're at the end of the promo for Pure Color. Maybe this is when we're getting you, and whether you're comfortable or happy to talk about what you kind of are working on at the moment or thinking of next or not.
I started something, this summer, and then, but it's something that I've sort of been taking notes about or for the last year and a half or so. And it's just kind of, yeah, like suddenly preoccupying me, and probably I don't want to talk about it yet just because I don't know.
Yeah.
I just don't have any reason to talk about it, but I do feel like happy to be sort of in something new, because when I'm not, you know, which was the case, just, you know, at the beginning of the summer, it's just a horrible feeling. You know, you have all this energy that you don't know where to put. And so it just goes into, you know, myriad dissatisfactions. And, I don't know, it's just not a very healthy way to live, to not be doing the thing that you love. So, but you can't always be doing it also.
Well, we're very happy that you are doing it and that you have done it so beautifully so many times and that you could join us today. And thank you so much. Everyone, I don't know
thank
if you can hear
it. I wish I could be there in person. Oh. Thank you so much for this.
You're getting a big clap. I don't know if you can hear it, but you should know that.
Thank you.
Bye.
So nice talking to you.
Thanks, Sheila. Have
a nice day.
You too. And a good night. And good day for you guys.
Thanks for listening. This series was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we work. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past and present. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.